So in the last session, we started to talk about meditation. So just to review a couple of things we looked at before we move on in this session. So we said that meditation is coming from the Sanskrit word bhavana, which literally means to familiarize or cultivate. And so the act of meditation is to familiarize and cultivate positive qualities and insight and so forth. And all meditations can be categorized a number of different ways. One way of categorizing all meditations that's often emphasized, particularly in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, is to divide all meditations into two groups, what's called stabilizing meditation and analytical meditation. Stabilizing meditation, as we saw, is simply meditation to stabilize our mind, to cultivate a calm, clear, focused mind. And often in the Tibetan tradition, this stabilizing meditation is called shamatha practice, often translated into English as calm abiding practice, the practice of developing a calm, clear, focused mind. Because this is the basis of analytical meditation. And again, analytical meditation, as the name suggests, is where we analyze and investigate. And there are many different types of analytical meditation. Within that, two of the main core groups of meditation are the area of wisdom and compassion, the two wings of practice. In the wisdom wing, often the Sanskrit word we see is vipassana or Pali vipassana, meaning special insight or insight in English, gaining an insight into the nature of reality, because it's our distorted view of reality that, according to Buddhism, is the root of all of our suffering. So we are to cultivate our insight into reality as a solution, balanced with the compassion wing of practice. And there we look briefly at these four elements of loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. So if we want any of our analytical meditations to be effective, we need to have a stable mind, a stable, calm, clear mind. In fact, in our practice, we can talk about going through three stages. And here I like to use the Tibetan words because they're very short. The three stages is go, nyam, tok. Go in Tibetan means intellectual understanding. So, of course, first, if we want to cultivate or familiarize ourselves with something, then we need to gain an intellectual understanding of what that thing is. So that's the first stage. But if we only do that, if we only gain an intellectual understanding of what is the nature of reality, what is compassion, what is loving kindness, that in itself is not really going to transform our life. We need to then bring our intellectual understanding into experience. So that is the second stage, nyam. Nyam means taste or experience. And that is where we meditate on the ideas that we've come to understand. You know, one example we looked at this morning is we already have an intellectual understanding of impermanence. We all intellectually understand that things are changing moment by moment because we learned that at school. Science has proven that. So that's something we already have an intellectual understanding of. But as we saw this morning, that intellectual understanding that things are changing moment by moment is not really helping us much in our life, because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding, it's driven by our instinctive habits. And our instinctive habit is telling us that this cup is pretty well the same cup that was here yesterday, it'll be the same cup here tomorrow. So we're relating to things in a distorted way, because there is no static, unchanging cup here. But that's how we're relating to it. And that's why we run into difficulties in our life. So if we want impermanence to benefit us, we need to go from here to here. We need to make not just intellectual understanding of impermanence, but we want to experientially see things as changing moment by moment. So that will affect how we interact with them. To do that, to go from here to here, we need to meditate. But We need to internalize our intellectual understanding to come to experience or have a taste of impermanence in meditation. If we can manage to do that, then what we will find is that that experience of impermanence in meditation may be affecting our mind a little bit after the meditation, maybe for some minutes, hours, or days. After the meditation, experientially, things will be seeming to be more in this flow state. And then we're interacting with things in a correct way. Less problems, less craving, less aversion. But then eventually that'll wear off and we'll go back to our normal habit. So what we need to do is we need to stabilize that. We need to make it longer lasting. So we need to go to the third stage, TOC, which is realization. To realize impermanence or realize anything implies we need a very stable, clear mind to have a direct experience of that in meditation. We need a very stable and clear mind. Without that, there's no way we're going to get here. If our mind is full of dullness and distraction, we're barely going to get here. Maybe not even get here. So the more stable and clear our mind is, the more we can start to experience things in meditation and then eventually come to directly realize that in meditation. That's why the stabilizing meditation is the basis of all analytical meditations. Because if we don't have a somewhat stable and clear mind, we're not probably even going to experience things in meditation. We're just going to get caught up in dullness and distraction, and certainly we won't be able to realize it. Because this is what's really going to start to transform our mind. Because then, if we realize impermanence in meditation, that's a stable experience, that will affect our mind after meditation more stably. So we'll start to be really in that state 24/7 of seeing things flowing, therefore more in tune with reality. So therefore, we need to put effort into our meditation practice of shamatha to have as a basis of both the compassion and wisdom wings, so we can get to these levels and then really start to transform our mind and transform our life. So, shamatha practice. We looked at the preparation of how to prepare ourselves well for meditation. Now we're going to look at the actual practice in more detail. So, here then, a number of things we need to look at. The first is, what qualities are we trying to cultivate in the shamatha practice? And traditionally in the meditation text, two things are mentioned. And that is stability and clarity, meaning we're trying to stabilize our mind so that we can focus on any given object without becoming distracted. But not only do we want a stable mind, we want to be able to focus on that object in a very clear way. So this is clarity. Now, of course, what's stopping us from having a stable and clear mind is distraction. We're trying to stabilize our mind, we just constantly get distracted. What's stopping our mind from focusing in a clear way, of course, is dullness. So these are the two most common faults in the shamatha practice that we're trying to overcome. Often in the text, the technical word for distraction you see is excitement, because that's the most common form of distraction. And the technical word you see here is laxity. Laxity and excitement, or dullness distraction. I like to add a third quality that we to cultivate here, one that's not often mentioned, but I think for many of us is very important. And that is relaxation. Because the reality is that we come into meditation practice, very hectic lifestyle, a lot of agitation, stress, and so our minds are quite agitated. And generally in our daily life, as I mentioned this morning, whenever we want to focus on anything, we tend to tense. Because if we don't tense, we know we're going to get distracted. So we tense to be able to focus. And if we do that for a short time, that can sort of work. But we know from our own experience, if we need to focus longer term with tension, we often become completely exhausted and often get very agitated. So this is not the approach we want here. To focus in this practice, to have a stable mind, we don't want tension. In fact, that is the fault that we're trying to overcome. And it's probably the number one reason people have difficulty as a beginner in meditation, is that people are simply too tight, too tense, trying too hard. And if we do that, then we have a lot of agitation. And then often people complain that their meditation gives them headaches. They become exhausted from meditation. So we don't really want to go there. So in daily life, we tend to oscillate between two extremes. When we're alert, we're super tense. When we're relaxed, we're completely dull. So what we need to do is combine the alertness with the relaxation and not be alert and tense or relaxed and dull. So therefore, if we want to have a stable and clear mind, the basis is relaxation. If we don't have a relaxed body and a relaxed mind, there's no way we can develop these in any reasonable way. Of course, with some tension, in the short term, maybe our mind is stable and clear, but the side effects are, the cost is huge, the cost of exhaustion and agitation. So it's not going to work. So we need to relax first, then stabilize the mind, then develop clarity. We need to develop in this order. So these are the qualities that we need to develop. Now, unfortunately, in the meditation texts, this was not hardly ever mentioned. I think historically, when these texts were written, people tended to be quite chilled and relaxed. In fact, the problem was in those days, people were too chilled and relaxed. So actually, what you find in the meditation text, the very first instruction, and you'll see this pretty well everywhere in the meditation text on shamatha, focus intently, attentively on the object. Firmly focus the mind on the object. That's the instruction. And then we see that and we go, okay, I can do that. Boom. And we clamp down. And then, of course, we have all sorts of problems. So we don't want to do that. We need to make sure we're relaxed, relaxed, relaxed. On a relaxed body and mind, we can stabilize the mind. With a stable mind, we can make it more clear. We need to have that structure. Otherwise, it's not going to work. I know from experience and many people I talk to. So these are the qualities we're trying to cultivate in the shamatha practice. Then what object should we focus on? Because here we're focusing on a single object. And again, here in the meditation texts, as listed as suitable objects, you'll get a very long list of possibilities. And the general recommendation here is use the object that works best for you, is the general recommendation. Having said that, probably the object that is most emphasized in shamatha practice in the Buddhist traditions is the breath. And often the meditation texts will go on to say, if you're the type of person who is highly discursive, meaning always thinking, 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 then definitely the best object for you is the breath. So I think that accounts for about 95% of the modern day population. We're all living in the head, thinking, 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 often tormented by our own mind. So by focusing on the breath, the physical sensations of the breath, we get out of our discursive conceptual mind and into the body. So that's a good start. And most of our conceptual thinking is about the past and the future. And from a Buddhist perspective, living in the past and future is a source for a lot of unhappiness. So the physical sensations of the breath, of course, only happen in the present moment. So by focusing on them, we get out of our conceptual mind and into the body, and we get out of the past and the future into the present moment. So this is a very good start. Within the breath practice, there are at least three variations of that. There is what's called the full body breath practice, and that's a little bit what we did this morning. and that is simply to focus on sensations associated with the breath in any part of the body. And this is a very diffuse object, and by using this as the object, this can be very helpful to work on relaxing the body and mind. So full body breath practice, very good for relaxation, particularly using the Shavasana or corpse posture. Then there's another variation which we'll be doing in this session now. And that is to focus on the area of the abdomen, the rising and lowering of the abdomen as we breathe, emphasized in a lot of Buddhist traditions, particularly a lot of the Theravada traditions, emphasize this. This, again, a fairly large area of focus, not so difficult to focus on. So this is particularly good to help stabilize the mind, to overcome distraction. And then the third variation of the breath practice, which is quite widely emphasized in Buddhist traditions, is to focus at the entrance of the nostrils. Of course, this is a much smaller area of focus, and because it's a more subtle object, therefore it's very helpful in improving clarity of attention. And this is quite widely recommended or emphasized in many Buddhist traditions. But again, I think for us in our modern society, if we start here, we need to be very careful, particularly if we're the sort of person who's very tense and agitated. Because this is a subtle object, and because it's subtle and it's not so easy to focus on, the real tendency can be we use our normal habit of tensing to focus. And because it's subtle, we think, oh, I need to tense more to pick it up. And so people often, if they start here in Shamatha practice, end up a lot of tension and then often complain they get headaches from meditating. So even though it's highly recommended, particularly if we're the sort of person who has a lot of tension, we need to be very careful at the beginning phase not to be tight and tense. So therefore, if we're using this and we're finding a lot of sensations across the forehead here, in the neck, a lot of tightness and tension, we don't want to stay there because we're going to develop very bad habits. What we can do is go back to one of these two variations. So bring the attention down from up here down to the abdomen or full body and really emphasize relaxation. And then once we've relaxed, if we want, then we can go back and stay focused at the nostrils. So this is the breath practice that's very widely emphasized. Another object that I think is particularly useful for us in our modern society is the mind. To focus on the mind itself, because here, again, in our modern society, we tend to be the slaves of our mind, meaning that we are often tormented by our own minds. Whenever something comes up in our mind, a thought, emotion, memory, what we do instinctively, automatically, normally, is we simply identify with that, we follow it, and we get caught up in our stories, and we often get overwhelmed by them. And also, of course, if something unpleasant comes up in our mind, an unpleasant thought, emotion, memory, we don't often know how to deal with it, what do? Try and stuff it back down, suppress it. But that brings a whole lot of other problems, because by suppressing these negative mental events, it's not dealing with them, often they manifest as a lot of physical problems. So I think a lot of modern day physical illness is simply from suppressed mental events. And then often because of that, we also project a lot of negativity onto others. For example, often people who have anger issues and they don't know how to deal with it, they suppress it. They even suppress it to the point where they deny that they're angry. Me, I'm not angry. But because they're suppressing, they feel the tension in the body. So they know there's anger, but it's not me, it's them. They're the angry ones. So then we often project a lot of this negativity onto others because we sense it, but we've denied it because we're suppressing it. Unfortunately, some modern therapies rightly understand that suppressing these things is very harmful, but unfortunately sometimes the therapy they offer is to overcome suppression, they simply flip to the other extreme of expression. Anger, suppressed anger, of course, harmful. But then often the solution that's given is express it, let it out. Of course, temporarily that relieves the tension, and so maybe for a short time you feel good because you've released that. But from a Buddhist perspective, it's a disaster because all you've done is you've increased your habit of getting angry. Okay, the therapy we may say shout at a wall or hit a pillow or something, but yes, today maybe we're shouting at a wall or hitting a pillow, but we're strengthening the habit of getting angry, so maybe tomorrow we're smashing someone's face instead of a pillow. So from a Buddhist perspective, we don't need to express to overcome suppression. We just need to do this. Simply this, and that is to observe our own mind. So in this practice, we are developing the capacity of being the observer or witness of our own mind, simply observing mental events, thoughts, emotions, memories, as they arise and pass. And every time we can do that, we're not feeding them. Because now what we do is we feed them. When it comes up, we identify, we follow, or we suppress. And both of those is feeding. And so therefore, the habit of mental garbage coming up will get stronger and stronger. And so we don't need to fight with our mind to, you know, to make it still. You know, we want a still mind. So what people often do is they fight with their mind. Fighting with the mind trying to make the still is like throwing petrol on the fire. It's just not going to work. We don't need to fight with the mind, but also we don't need to give in. All we need to do is just step back and watch. That's it. Nothing complicated. Step back and watch. And as long as we can do that, these mental events actually have no power over us. I mean, if we look at what a thought or emotion or memory is in itself, it's virtually nothing. It can't do anything to harm us. The only way a thought, emotion, or memory can harm us is if we do one of two things. We identify with it and follow it, or we try to suppress it. Then we give it power. But if we just observe it, I mean, it's nothing. It's nothing. Virtually, it's not like someone smashing us over the head with a stick. I mean, they themselves, they're virtually nothing. They have no power in themselves. If they only have power if we give them power. And in this practice, we're not giving any power to any of these mental events. We're simply observing them arise and pass, arise and pass. And if we do that, we're not feeding the habit. So this garbage, the habit of them coming up, will get weaker and weaker. Our mind will naturally be more quiet and still. And because we're also developing the ability to observe the mind, to be the witness, if in the future some strong mental event were to arise, we could simply be present with it and not get overwhelmed with it. So we, instead of being the slaves of our mind now, this practice not only will give us a relaxed, stable and clear mind and a calm mind, it will mean that we'll become the masters of our mind. Not the slaves of our mind. So instead of our mind being our worst enemy, it will become our best friend. So this is some of the benefits of observing the mind in the shamatha practice. Now, many people find this very challenging for two reasons. One is the mind is not physical. So the breath is physical, the sensations of breath, a little bit easier to focus on. It's not physical, it's mental, so a little bit more subtle. But also, of course, the other area of difficulty people have here is that we have such a strong habit of always following our thoughts, emotions, memories, or suppressing. So therefore, to simply start to observe is not so easy. But again, Shanti Deva's advice, we can keep that in mind. No matter how difficult something seems, everything with practice becomes easy. So all we got to do is develop the habit of observing. That's all. So practice, practice, and we will be able to observe the mind. And then we'll become the masters of our mind. There's a third object that also can be very helpful in our modern society. And that is no object. Sometimes this is called awareness of awareness. In this practice, what we are doing is simply resting in awareness itself. This is a little bit what we did in the first meditation this morning. Generally, people find this quite difficult. Again, not because it's something complicated. It's actually because it's too simple. Because here in this practice, effectively, we're not doing anything at all. In these practices, we're still doing something. Here we are focusing on the sensations of the breath. Here we are observing the mind and all the mental events. Whereas in this one, effectively, we're not really doing anything. Instead of doing, we're being. We are simply resting in awareness itself. Simply being aware of being aware. Generally, we're not familiar with that. So therefore, people find it difficult because we always want to do something. You know, when this is explained, people go, but what have I got to do? What am I supposed to be doing in this meditation? And that's the whole problem, is doing. So we want to stop doing and be. And this is something new to us. We don't know how to be. But again, it's so simple. And it can be easy if we just familiarize ourselves with it. Because with this practice, another reason that's so beneficial in our modern society is, again, we are all about doing, and we always get caught up in appearances. Whenever we receive appearance, we identify with it, we get caught up in it, and we contract around appearances, and our mind becomes very small and constricted, and we're tormented by our mind. Whereas in this practice, as we saw this morning, this state of simply resting in awareness, there are no boundaries or constrictions. It's completely open and spacious, and that experience is an experience of stillness. So if we can rest in that open, spacious stillness, then we can stop constricting around appearances. And if we can get into that experience, it means that in daily life, we can still be in that open, spacious awareness in the midst of appearances without getting caught up in the appearances. And the other reason this can be very beneficial is, as this morning, by simply resting in being aware of being aware, we are starting to get in touch with the mind itself. What is the mind? You know, this morning we saw the conventional nature of the mind was, it was clear and knowing, or having clarity and awareness. So simply resting in awareness, these become very obvious, clarity and awareness. But also simply resting in awareness, we can start to intuit the ultimate nature of the mind. What is the ultimate nature of the mind? And that is vipassana practice. So by simply resting in awareness, intuitively we could come to realize the ultimate nature of the mind, the nature of our mind. So this is a very good bridge into the vipassana practice. It itself, of course, is simply a shamatha practice. So these are three variations, or three objects, that I think in our modern society can be very beneficial. Of course, there are many other objects that are possible. Any of you who have been in the Tibetan Buddhism, particularly in the Gelug school, when it comes to the shamatha practice, often the one object that is emphasized is mental image of a Buddha. And then people try that and it's very difficult because we don't know how to visualize very well and we're not so familiar with Buddha. So many people who try that think, wow, that's too complicated. And then also often here, some of the traditions say, you know, oh, you even find the breath too difficult to focus on? Okay, get yourself a stick or a pebble, put it in front of you and look at it. So use a visual object to start with. So this is a very coarse object, but it could be a good object to start with. And then use that for some time until the mind becomes more relaxed, stable, and a bit clear. Then shift to mental object. Instead of looking at the pen, observe mental image of the pen. So this is possible. So this is some objects to use. Any questions on that? Yeah.
If you're using the abdominal breath as the object,
sure.
Would you first of all have to consciously lengthen out the breathing process? Because it seems to me if you're visualizing at the nostrils, then the breath is where it naturally comes in the body, is to the mid lobes of the lungs. We don't generally breathe to the abdomen.
Right. So here with...
Consciously.
Yeah. So... One thing we need to be aware of here, of course, is when we say the breath is the object, we're talking about the tactile sensations of the breath. We're not talking about visualizing the breath coming in, going down, going back up and out. There are some practices where you do that for a particular reason, but that's not the practice here of the breath. So we're not visualizing anything here. The object is physical sensations of the breath in this area. We could use a mental visualization as an object of shamatha practice. That's possible, but that's not what we're explaining here. So when we're talking about using the breath here, we're talking about the actual tactile sensations, either at this point, or in a more general point. So that's the first point we need to be clear about here, is that we're talking about the actual tactile sensations. And you're right, often we don't know how to breathe very well.
Most people don't breathe.
Exactly. So what we can do as a separate exercise, not mixed in, is do some breath work, pranayama or whatever, to improve our breathing in general, because a healthy body supports a healthy mind. But what we don't want to be doing is mixing that in our shamatha practice, because then we're getting mixed up. So yes, as a separate exercise, if we breathe poorly, we may look at doing some breath work to help us with that. But when we're doing this practice, we're not doing any breath manipulation. We are simply allowing the breathing to do its natural thing. And that's also another reason why keeping the back straight is helpful, because if we're hunched over, we're constricting, and then again, the breath is probably not really going to go to the abdomen very much. And so if we're focusing here, we're not going to notice much. But so therefore, it's important, again, to have a good posture with this. So again, with the breath practice, we can pick any of those variations that we feel works best for us. It's not like we have to start here and then we have to go here and then we have to go here. Not necessary, but you may find as a beginner, if we go here, we maybe don't pick up anything and we're too tight, then maybe we should go back and use one of these for some time.
So there's not enough breath coming in if you just focus here. If you're a beginner, you're not getting enough oxygen into your body. You're not getting enough energy in if you're just focusing here, if you're not used to breathing correctly.
Right, but again, even if we're focusing here, it's not like we're restricting the breathing in any way. We're allowing the breath to flow naturally. Yeah. So that's something very important with any of these, is we're not trying to be rhythmic, deep, subtle. We're not trying to do anything with the breath. Just let it do its own thing. And here, now, of course, when we begin, often people notice nothing. But that's not because there's no sensations here. It's because our mind is very dull. We're not picking up the sensations. So it's not a matter of, you know, that's the thing is, often when people start here and they don't pick up anything, what they do is they force their breath so they can pick something up, but we don't want to go there. That's not going to help. Rather, stay patiently here and eventually you'll start, as you overcome dullness and your mind becomes more clear, you'll start to pick up sensations. Or if you're not really picking up anything, go back to a more coarse object for a while. So this is some of the recommendations, I think, with the breath. Anything else anyone would like to... So again, as a beginner, you could use any visual object. You could even use a sound as an object. But these tend to be very coarse objects. And we will need to go beyond that if we really want to go deeper into the practice. So yes, you could use a candle or even chanting a mantra or something. But these tend to be focusing on anything can help. But again, these sorts of sensory objects tend to be quite coarse and we won't be able to go too far with them. We'll need to make it more subtle. So yes, it's possible as a beginning point to start with something like that, looking at something or even a repetitive sound or something. But again, we'll need to go beyond that if we really want to move forward. Because actually, at the higher levels of shamatha practice, what we find is that the sense faculties actually shut down when we get quite high in the shamatha practice. So we will have no sensory faculties manifest. We won't even have any spatial awareness of the body at some point. So then it will have to move to a mental object. But that happens quite later.
Next week, yes.
Not this week, next week. We get there. Okay. Tools. So the two tools, two main tools in this practice is mindfulness and introspection. Mindfulness, the original Sanskrit word was smriti, the Pali word sati. Both of these words means literally to remember. So mindfulness is simply remembering the object. It's our ability to hold the object without becoming distracted. So that's the primary tool in this practice. We are trying to hold the object using the rope of mindfulness. But then, of course, we need to monitor that to notice if we're becoming dull or distracted. So that's introspection. Introspection is like quality control. Introspection is monitoring the mindfulness. You know, are we still on the object or are we becoming dull or distracted? So once we notice that we're becoming dull or distracted, then simply reapply the mindfulness. So these are the two main tools we're using in this practice. And we can see that on your chart here, which we're going to start to look at a little bit more now, is that these are nine stages up to shamatha. Shamatha is the diagram in the middle at the top. And we see right down the bottom here at the beginning stage, we see the meditator, and in their left hand is a rope. In their right hand is a hook. So the left, the rope, is symbolizing mindfulness. We're trying to tie our mind to the observed object using the rope of mindfulness. And then the hook of introspection is to notice if we're becoming dull or distracted and then hook the mind back to the object. So these are the symbolism of mindfulness and introspection in this diagram. And then if we look over the back, we have a little chart up the top here that talks about the faults and antidotes. And at the top, there's a sentence that says, shamatha is attained by progressing through the nine stages. And the nine stages are these nine diagrams on the windy path up to shamatha. Relying on the eight antidotes to abandon the five faults. So, therefore, to achieve shamatha, we apply these antidotes to overcome these faults. And the first fault we see there is laziness. So, like anything, we tend to be lazy with any activity in our life if we see no benefit in it. If we don't see any benefit in a certain activity, we tend to be very lazy when it comes to doing it. Similarly here in meditation, if we really don't appreciate the benefits of this practice, we're going to be very lazy when it comes to doing it. So the first antidote to laziness here is faith. So faith here means to reflect on the benefits of the practice. If we can really see the benefits of this practice, we're going to have faith that this practice is really going to give us a lot of benefit. So we'll have the first antidote, faith. Faith that this practice will really bring us a lot of benefit. If we have faith in the practice that it's going to benefit us, we'll have the second antidote. It means aspiration. We'll want to do the practice because we'll see the benefits. And then if we have aspiration to do the practice, we're going to put a lot of effort into the practice, the third antidote. And if we put a lot of effort into the practice, we're going to slowly get the fourth antidote, pliancy. Pliancy here is flexibility or serviceability of the body and mind. Meaning the more we go into the shamatha practice, the more flexible and serviceable both our body and mind become as we progress in the practice. The second fault here is forgetfulness. So, of course, the antidote to that is mindfulness. So to remember the object, to remember the instructions of the practice. And then the third fault, the main pair of faults, laxity and excitation, or in other words, dullness and distraction. So the antidote to that is introspection, meaning introspection is quality control. Introspection is monitoring our mindfulness. Are we becoming dull or distracted? And if we become dull or distracted, reapply mindfulness. The fourth fault here is non-application. Non-application means that we've recognized that our mind has become dull or distracted, but we don't do anything about that. That's a bit of a problem. That's a fault. So to overcome that, the antidote is application, means do something. So if you notice that your mind has become dull or distracted, fix the problem. Reapply mindfulness. Then the last fault here is over-application. For us as beginners, that's not really a big problem because we need to be fixing our mind a lot. But as we progress in the practice, then there will come a point where we're actually focusing on the object well, but we're still adjusting our focus unnecessarily. We're still tampering with our focus unnecessarily. That's a fault. That's over-application. The antidote is equanimity. And here equanimity means balance, means leave the mind as it is. It's going well. Don't touch it. So here the phrase, of course, is if it's not broken, don't fix it. Just leave it. So that becomes a bit of an issue later in our practice if we're over-fixing things when we don't need to. But unfortunately for beginners, we're pretty well broken most of the time. We need to keep fixing. So for us, it's not really a big issue over application as a beginner. The main one is, or the more common, of course, is non-application, that we're not fixing things when we should be. So these are the five faults and the eight antidotes. And then following those, overcoming those five faults with the eight antidotes, we can progress along these nine stages to shamatha. So maybe I can explain briefly a little bit more, a little bit about those nine stages, maybe just a couple of brief points that can be beneficial for us as beginners, and then we'll go back into another meditation. And this next meditation, we're going to be focusing on the abdomen as the object. So let's have a look briefly at the chart, though, and see if there's some useful practical advice. So again, we're down the bottom here. We saw that the mindfulness is symbolized by the rope in the left hand, introspection symbolized by the hook in the right hand. Then we see the elephant, and most of this, of course, is written on the back. So you see all these little numbers on the front, and the explanation is on the back. So most of the things I'm going to say now are actually described on the back page. The elephant here is the mind. The fact that it's black is symbolizing this dullness or laxity. And then we have the monkey. The monkey is symbolizing conceptual thought in general. And the fact that it's black is symbolizing this excitement, the most common form of distraction. So here at stage one, which is called setting the mind, we see that the elephant and monkey are running wildly ahead of us, which means at stage one of shamatha practice, what we notice is that our mind is completely out of control, that we try to focus on the breath, for example, as the object, and within usually 3 or 4 seconds, we're gone, completely distracted. And maybe some minutes later, we realize, hang on, I'm supposed to be focusing on the breath. We come back to the breath for another 3 or 4 seconds and then gone again for another 4 or 5 minutes. So this is describing stage one. Now, what often happens, and I think I briefly mentioned this morning, is that when people start to do this practice, then before we start to do this practice, people have this idea that, you know, my mind's not too bad. You know, I think I should be able to focus on the breath sort of okay. You know, I might get a bit dull or distracted, but I think I can do that okay. And of course, when we sit down and we can't focus and we're constantly distracted, then often people come to this conclusion, well, I just can't meditate, you know, I just can't meditate. In fact, I must be doing something wrong because my mind is worse since I started meditating than it was before. Before it was sort of okay, now it's a big mess, so I must be doing something wrong. And then on top of that, what people do often is they open their eyes and they look around and everyone else is super still. I'm the only one who can't meditate in this room, so I'm hopeless, you know. actually you can meditate, you're actually making progress. Because the first sign of progress is simply to see how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. Because until we actually try to focus on a single object, we don't realize how chaotic and out of control our mind really is. So that actually is the first sign of progress, is to notice how chaotic and out of control our mind is. So if that's your experience, good work, you're making progress. If we then continue our practice, we'll get around to stage two, around the corner. And here we see the monkey and elephant are not running so fast anymore, and they have a little bit of white on top of their head. So that little bit of white on the head is symbolizing the stability and clarity, meaning now our mind is getting a little bit stable and clear, meaning at stage two of the practice, there will be periods in your meditation where you'll notice your mind calms down a bit more stable, more clear. Maybe we can hold the object for a minute or two before we're distracted. But often, even at stage two, we're more distracted than we are on the object. But then if we patiently continue the practice, we'll get round the corner to stage three. And here we see the rope of mindfulness now is tied to the elephant of the mind, meaning now our mindfulness is getting a lot better, meaning by stage three of the practice, we can hold the object for maybe 5 to 10 minutes before we become distracted. And now, when we become distracted, we quickly recognize that and quickly come back. So that's symbolized by the elephant turning the head backwards, meaning we quickly recognize distraction and quickly come back. But now we see the rabbit has entered into the picture on the back of the elephant. And actually the rabbit is enemy number one of the shamatha meditator. So it's not like in the Matrix where Neo has followed the white rabbit. Here, we don't want to do that. So in shamatha practice, we need to notice the rabbit and then let go of the rabbit. So rabbit is symbolizing what's called subtle dullness. Because by stage three of the practice, our mind is getting much more stable, meaning we can hold the object longer periods and quickly come back if we become distracted. So our mindfulness, our stability is improving a lot, but clarity is still missing. So the quality of our attention still needs a lot of work done. So what we need to do from stage three onwards is to notice that our mind is not very clear. Of course, it was always there, the rabbit, but stage one and two, we had much more serious problems to worry about than a little bit of subtle dullness. So by stage three, though, subtle dullness starts to become a bit of an issue. And if we don't pick it up, we can get stuck here in the shamatha practice. We can simply be holding the object most of the session, thinking, oh, I'm nearly at shamatha now, because I hardly ever get distracted. But we get stuck there because we don't notice that our mind is not very sharp. So we have to notice that our mind is actually a bit dull and start to tweak the attention. Similarly, at stage four, now our mindfulness is getting very good, meaning we can hold the object the entire session without ever completely losing it. Still, we have a lot of work to do on the quality of our attention. You may have noticed if you've done a bit of shamatha practice that sometimes you're holding the object, you're focusing on the breath, but somehow we can do that and think about breakfast at the same time. You know, nice little trick, isn't it? So this is like background noise and static. So this we need to sort of slowly let go of. So we're trying to improve the quality of our attention. So particularly you see over stage five and six, now the hook of introspection is more prominent. So over stage in five and six in particular, we are trying to fine-tune our focus. And the analogy often given here is the analogy of a guitar string. If a guitar string is too tight or too loose, it doesn't play well. Likewise, if our mind is too tight or too relaxed, too loose, it doesn't focus well. So here we are fine-tuning our focus. If we're too dull, sharpen the focus. If we're a little bit agitated, relax a little bit. So it's tightening and loosening. And so we keep doing that, fine-tuning our focus, and then we'll get round to stage 7 and 8 and 9. And by these stages, by particularly stage 8 and 9, now the rabbit is gone. We've said goodbye to the monkey. There's virtually no black on the elephant. So now by stage 8 and 9, we can focus on the object for a long time, 2 to 3 hours no problem, without any hint of any subtle dullness or agitation for 2 to 3 hours, no problem, effortlessly. And then eventually, if we keep practicing from stage 9, then what happens is this radical transition in the body and mind happens. And at that point, we end up with what's called physical and mental pliancy. There's a very realignment of all the subtle energies in the body, and now our body becomes what's called pliant, means our body becomes completely serviceable, meaning we have no physical problems in the body interrupting our meditation, and our mind becomes completely serviceable. There's no resistance whatsoever to meditation. And then we achieve shamatha. So in shamatha, we have this physical and mental pliancy. Physical pliancy is symbolized here, you see in the middle at the top, person is flying through the air. That's physical pliancy. It's said that when we achieve shamatha, our body feels light like cotton. So that's symbolized here by the person flying through the air. And then the mental pliancy or serviceability means we can direct our mind at will to whatever we want without any resistance whatsoever. And that's symbolized by the meditator on sitting on the elephant of the mind. They can turn the elephant of the mind to whatever they want without any problem whatsoever. So this is shamatha. And then we saw on the basis of developing this calm, clear, focused mind of shamatha, we can engage in practices, analytical practice such as vipassana, which is actually the last diagram in the top there. Now you see the meditator on the elephant of the mind and a sword in their right hand. That's the sword of wisdom to cut through ignorance. So that is symbolizing that on the basis of shamatha, we can really effectively engage in the vipassana practice. So that is very briefly the shamatha chart. Of course, there's a lot more to be said about that, but maybe for another time. Any questions on this before we go back to the meditation practice? Anything anyone would like to know about this chart?
One thing I'm curious about as well is it's all, presented as quite a linear path. You know, at the beginning, it almost seems completely unattainable, sort of long way ahead. And what I'm wondering about is whether, even in the early stages, although your mind is all over the place and so on, you do get glimpses of clarity.
Correct.
Is that true?
Yes.
Clarity of shamatha?
Yeah.
Or is it just you thinking, oh, I might be glimpsing something?
Yeah, exactly.
Is it the real thing?
Well, at least a facsimile. And here, actually, Alan Wallace uses a nice analogy. You know, like, let's say you want to play golf and you're a complete beginner and you're hacking the ball all over the place. Yeah. You might get lucky and hit a hole in one, no?
Yeah.
Does that mean you're a pro golfer? No, but I mean, that's sort of an indication of what's to come, isn't it?
Yeah.
That you can do that consistently, you know, hit a good shot consistently.
Right.
So similarly here, you know, we said stage 3 means that you can sort of focus, as an example. Stage 3, you can focus on the object 5 or 10 minutes. If you become distracted, quickly come back. You may find now, as a beginner, you can do that maybe in one session. That can happen. That doesn't mean you're at stage 3.
Okay.
Same thing as Alan Wall says. Just because you maybe hit a birdie or something doesn't mean you're a pro golfer.
Yeah.
What it means to be at that stage, it means, is that your average experience? So at stage 3, if that's your average experience, that means it's stage 3. So if you're at stage 3, you may find one session you're 100% on the object the whole session. In another meditation, you may find you're quite distracted. But on average, your average experience is you can hold the meditation object 5 or 10 minutes and usually you quickly come back. That's what it means to be at stage 3. So you can have variations, good days, bad days, but that's the average.
Because otherwise, it can seem very disheartening, we're going to be forever at this beginner stage, so the goal is so far.
Right, but again, the thing we need to remember, and that's unfortunately what people do, they look at this and they go, oh, that's too difficult, I'm not going to try. But see, the thing is that, yes, you need to put a lot of effort. It's the same as like, if you want to be a concert pianist, to think that you can practice for 30 minutes each day to be a concert pianist. I mean, you're never going to be a concert pianist.
Yeah.
But what we're saying here is that even if we get to stage two or three, we're going to start to see benefit in our life. And the more benefit to see, the more ability we'll have, the more we'll want to do it. So, yes, now we look at the shamatha and we go, oh, that's too difficult. But then it would be a shame to say, because we need to put a lot of effort there, I'm not even going to bother. Because any little effort we do will bring us benefit. So whatever capacity we have will bring that benefit. And the more benefit we receive, you'll probably find your capacity will increase as well. So rather than, you know, it's the same, you know, we're grasping to the result, always grasping to the result. We're always looking in the future. Am I there yet? Am I there? Oh, no, it's hopeless. I'm not there yet. I mean, we're never, the only time is present moment. So therefore, to understand the path and not get caught up, am I there yet, am I there yet, oh, it's too big, too hopeless. Rather, in the present moment, we put whatever effort we can manage, and then we'll receive the benefit. And then we can go somewhere. But if we have the idea of, you know, oh, I need to get there, I need to get that, that's actually going to block us. It's going to make things more difficult because we're going to have attachment and aversion. So we need to let that go and be in the present and put whatever effort we can. And we'll receive the benefit. Otherwise, we're the same as normal. We're living in the future. And we're not going to, we're missing out on the very opportunity we have to change. So that's important. Okay. Anything else? Otherwise, we'll go back to another meditation. Yeah.
I thought we needed specific retreat conditions.
Right.
And length of 6 months.
But
that's what
happened. Yeah. So again, if we really want to, I mean, it's the same thing, being concert pianist, we need to dedicate. But now, of course, given whatever our life conditions are, we apply whatever we can. And then what you will find, actually, and this actually is very well, very common, is that even people who go into this practice for maybe a more mundane reason. Oh, I just want to be more calm and peaceful at work and stuff. What's often the case is that actually as people progress in their practice with the motivation of wanting just to be more calm for work and something, if they really get into the practice, their whole perspective of life starts to shift. And then suddenly career and all that's not so important. The quality of life is more important, and then suddenly they've let go of all these extra things that flood their life, which are not helpful. You know, we fill up our life with a lot of stuff that doesn't really help us. So as we progress in this, what often happens is automatically these priorities shift as we see what is important in our life and what isn't, and then suddenly we find time and space and energy to go for a 1 week retreat where before we thought, oh, no, I'm just too busy, I can't do that. And then we do the 1 week retreat and then our priorities keep shifting. And then suddenly we say, okay, I'm going to take 3 months off work because this is going to be the best thing for me. And then do a 3 month retreat and then, you know, it goes on from there. So even though now you might think, oh, no, I just can't do it, I don't have any time for retreat. I think you'll find, and this is often the case, is that if we start to get into it, these things start shifting and it's just really a matter of priorities. And so, yes, it will become a more natural thing to want to do that because we see that, you know, okay, I can go a 2 week trip to Mallorca on the beach or I can do a 2 week meditation retreat. You know, Mallorca is not going to give me anything, you know, maybe a bit of sunburn or something, but 2 week retreat is going to really, I mean, it's going to help me a lot in my life. So let's do that. So this is probably what's going to happen. So you'll find that as things change, you'll start to shift priorities and you will find time for this. And then in terms of how much retreat and stuff, I mean, everyone's different. Everyone has different level capacity. So there's no says X amount of time you'll achieve shamatha. We can't do it like that. But again, whatever time and capacity we have, we just apply that and we'll bring the benefit. So if we get caught up in, I have to do 1,000 hours of shamatha practice or something, then again, we're grasping to some sort of result. And even if we do 1,000 hours, because we're caught up in the grasping, we're not going to receive the benefit. So
don't the Tibetans have all these conditions?
Yeah.
I remember learning all the conditions of like the water, the place where you do it,
yeah.
The history of that place, the energy.
Sure.
all those other things.
Yeah. So again, what we will find is that as we progress, we'll naturally start to move in a direction that provides more conducive conditions for us. I think it's more an organic thing rather than, oh, I have to... Because that's the thing is, when people sometimes see this, they go, okay, they quit their job, run off into a little cave or something for, I want to go and do a 3-year retreat, and then usually 2 weeks later they come running back out again. But, no, well, because they're not prepared, they're not ready. So we shouldn't think that, oh, therefore I need to quit my job now and go and meditate for a year or 3 years. I mean, that's not going to work for most people. So we need to do it in a step-by-step way, in an organic way, and then you'll find that things will unfold in a more healthy way for us as an individual. How that unfolds will vary greatly from individual to individual. Okay, let's do a short meditation before we take a tea break. So this time we're going to work with the abdomen, working on stabilizing the attention, but again, make sure we're nice and relaxed. And what I'm going to do in this meditation is introduce a little thing that's going to help stabilize the mind, and that is to count the breath. So by counting the breath, that can help stabilize the mind. How we do the counting, I'll introduce in the meditation. It's pretty well self-explanatory. So we're going to introduce a little bit of counting to see if that helps to stabilize our mind. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body, simply becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And again, using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Simply allowing the breathing to flow naturally and effortlessly. and without dwelling in the past, without anticipating the future, in particular, letting go of any expectations for this meditation. Simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now narrow your focus and focus on the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen, focusing on the rising and lowering of the abdomen as you breathe. Maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness of the sensations of the breath in the area of the abdomen throughout the entire cycle of each in and out breath. If you find yourself becoming distracted, then without getting upset, the very first thing to do is simply to relax. Then release the distraction and very gently return to focusing on the breath. So relax, release, and return every time you become distracted. And if you find that you're constantly becoming distracted, then as a way to help stabilize the mind, we can introduce counting the breath. So for this, at the end of the in-breath, mentally note one. And then focus on the sensations of the breath, on the following out-breath and following in-breath, and then mentally note two. And so in this way, we can count the breath from 1 up to 10, and then we can start back at 1 again. And if at any time you lose the count, simply go back to 1. So let's now experiment with counting the breath and see if it helps to stabilize our attention. with things like counting the breath. Some people find it helpful. Some people just find it another distraction. So if you find counting the breath is helpful, use it. But don't overuse it. Don't always use it. But just bring it in when you find that you're heavily distracted to help stabilize, and you can let go of it and just go back to counting the, focusing on the breath. If you find it just distraction from the very beginning, if you don't find it helpful, you leave it out. Also, a variation of counting the breath is some traditions, instead of counting the breath, do what's called noting, is mentally noting, breathing out, breathing in. Noting is also okay, but don't make it too elaborate. You know, otherwise it just becomes commentary on commentary on commentary. So keep it simple if you want to use noting. So they can be helpful. If you don't find it helpful, leave it out. Any questions? Otherwise, we'll go for a tea break. Okay, let's take a tea break. And in the last session, we'll have a look at how to integrate some of these meditation practices into our daily life.